Now, we've moved this down a level. And I'm going to phrase the question in a slightly different way. What do you have to do to actually do this?
Surrender.
Yeah, but that's somebody else's terminology, Julia, with all due respect. Raquel? You've been here.
About the feel like shit thing. I feel like shit. I don't know if that describes it. No, I'm just like carrying that for this. So. I'm not sure.
Okay.
My head has other terms.
Now, it's interesting how all of those terms flood in. Why do all of those terms flood in? What I want to suggest is that we go to those terms so that we avoid feeling it. And this is why I'm encouraging you in this. When you're talking about your experience, do not use jargon, do not use Buddhist terms, don't use anybody else's vocabulary. It's hard. It's very hard. Okay? What you have to do, what all of us have to do, is feel how this injunction, this instruction, rubs against all of that stuff we're so invested in. And so, it's not, if you go into it, we will feel sick to our stomach.
Yeah.
May feel burning in the heart or elsewhere, Emotionally, we'll feel betrayed by the teachings. What do you mean? This was so unjust. True, so. And then we have all of these stories that play around. So you've got, the usual drill. What do you experience in your body? What do you experience in your emotions? What are the stories? And that's experiencing the friction. Okay? Oh, when Robert says he experienced the wound, that's what he's talking about. But this is not about being in what is. This is about deliberately putting our habituated patterns into friction with a different perspective. So that we taste viscerally how invested and how attached we are to the way that we're used to experiencing the world. And it's not fun.
There's still that point where you really do know that it's not true.
Yes.
And that in a way it is some sort of solace, or at least it keeps you from...
Why do you hold on to...
Shit.
What are you trying to hold on to there, John? I mean, what you're raising here, in a very interesting way, and thank you for raising this. What is truth? And what bearing does truth have on your practice? No, I mean, this is the really radical nature of this stuff. It doesn't matter if it's true. That's another form of investment for us. So when we say, well, at least I know, I know I really didn't do this. You're trying to hold on to something. I'm not saying that you should believe the person. I'm not saying that at all. but it's a way of exiting from the friction. Okay?
I'm thinking of a specific situation, and my reaction was not anger with the person.
Mm-hmm.
I felt really very sad about it.
Yeah.
But they were experiencing that rather than
right.
being blamed for what.
And what does that leave you with after the situation?
Besides the hope that they'll come to their senses.
Yeah. How much does the situation weigh on you?
In this case, a great deal.
But is it the situation or the sadness? Yeah. Because, you're already moving in the direction of what Tome Tsongpo is talking about here. You aren't taking it personally. You see the suffering that this person must be experiencing to act this way. You feel great sadness about that. That's essentially compassion. And so what I'm trying to point out here is by moving in that direction, you actually don't carry the situation with you. Yeah.
But if you do that, I guess it's not you can do it too soon if you already feel it, but it just seems like if you're pushing yourself in the direction of, of just feeling sorry for the person who's doing whatever they're doing to you, you're not feeling the anger.
Yeah, you're quite right here, Raquel. If you're feeling sorry for, that's pity. That's not compassion. In compassion, there is no sense of superiority. The slightest bit of superiority, and you're in pity. Okay? Now, you may also recall from one of our earlier classes that I said there are three levels at which you work with stuff. If you can simply experience it completely in presence, then it arises and dissolves as released on its own. That's direct awareness level practice. But not all of us have that level of attention all the time. I will hold up my hand here. The second level of practice, the way Tibetan tradition looks at it, is this one, where we use the experience to grind at our habituated patterns, which means experiencing completely all of the ways that it rubs against our cherished notions of truth, justice, rightness in the world, self-importance, everything. Okay. But that only works if you actually can do that. Now, as I just described, I don't always have the level of attention or even intention to do that. I should, but I don't. And in that case, you move to the third level, which is you just don't do anything which causes further suffering, such as retaliate and stuff. You walk away. Now, what's very important to notice in this, none of this is about fixing the world out here. That is not the intention of Buddhist practice. One of the reservations I have about engaged Buddhism is that some of the proponents of engaged Buddhism say that social activism is a necessary result of practice. And if you aren't socially active, then you haven't, your practice isn't a real practice. Well, this goes a little bit against the grain because I think of people like Milarepa and others, you know, really great people in the course of history, Ajahn Chah, so forth. I mean, many, many contemporary and historical teachers who were very, very important people, but they were never what you would call socially active or engaged Buddhists, and yet they had profound influences because of the depth of their understanding, because they practiced like this. I want to put the other side on that. That's not to say that being socially active is not Buddhist. I don't subscribe to that at all. It depends absolutely on the person. And for some people, their path is going to be a path of service, which is essentially what social activism is. It's always a form of service of some kind. And that is their path, in the same way that my own path happens to be in teaching. And for other people, their path will be in retreat. And these are different paths that people can take in how they approach being awake and present in life.
Well, what's the difference between then Pratyeka Buddha and Bodhisattva?
Well, a Pratyeka Buddha is a construction of the Mahayanists to make Bodhisattvas look good. But it's important to remember. Okay, they said, you know, they have the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, and, you know, they come to a partial understanding, but it's not a complete understanding, and they don't really emphasize compassion, so etc., blah, blah, blah.
They're very specific. They say it's a practice of trying to become an arhat, to try to become an enlightened person, and that they may see the illusion of the self, but they don't see the illusion of all things.
Now, the way to work with these kinds of concepts, Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, they're not talking about people out there. Okay? George, I'm going to put you on the spot, all right? Is there any part of you that wants to become awake and enlightened and doesn't give a shit about anybody else?
Of course there's a part of you.
That's the Pratyeka Buddha.
But that's my point in the question about in this case being engaged in the world.
Yes, but how do you work with that part in you? That's the question to answer.
I think by breaking through my self-concern and self-cherishing.
Yeah, and this is one way of doing it. There are many, many others. But so when you're talking about Pratyeka Buddhas, we're talking about that pattern in us, or part of us, that, yeah, I just want out of this mess. I don't really care about anybody else. Okay?
This, that they contemplate the 12 points in reverse.
Yeah, this is tying it up to traditional. Yeah, that's a standard method. I've never found the 12 links to be a very helpful meditation. I think I've given it to one person. Traditionally, it's meant to counteract stupidity. But I've never found it that helpful in meditation. But what I want to focus on here is we have that part in ourselves. Okay. Now, when you feel it, what do you experience? Well, I'll just speak for me personally. When I work with that, I'm aware of that part, I feel my world is like that. Okay? That's how it feels. It's nice, but it's like that. And just becoming aware of that, I'm aware that it's a closing down in some sense. It's not actually an opening. And if I'm going to open to the totality of my experience, I've got to deal with absolutely everybody, whether I like them or not. And that's that. And it's not because I'm trying to inculcate some noble virtue in me, you know, and it's just that that's how it is. And if I'm serious about relating to the totality of my experience, then I have to relate to these very painful situations.
Whether it's on a small daily level or in teaching or in some other way, that's still being engaged in the world.
I'm not sure what you mean by being engaged in the world. I feel you're doing something slippery with language here, George. You change the meaning of the phrase, which is a standard trick of philosophers.
No, I don't think I'm doing that. What I think I'm saying is that you're not being concerned only with your own enlightenment if you're on this path.
Okay, I get your distinction. I'm engaging with the world of my experience.
Right.
When the phrase, and you were doing something slippery with language here, because the phrase engaged with the world does not usually mean engaged with the world of one's experience. It means engaged with the world that we project.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's a very different thing.
Yeah, but I wasn't using it that way as the world out there.
Okay.
But that the world in here is the same as the world out there. Because we're part of it.
Now you're doing that slippery thing again. I can feel it. Clint.
How does coming to awareness that you're closing down, coming to awareness, not become in and of itself a concept? I mean, where does it end?
In your body. You almost went there, Clint. In your body. Okay? Right now. Theo, I want to wake up and I don't really care about anybody else. We all can all relate to that. How does that feel physically? Yes, right now. Okay, that's your homework then. Pick it up next week. Does that make you feel better, Captain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gets homework.
Julia.
It was interesting. I was experiencing it as you were asking, and along with the closing down, I felt fear.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. But let's just do a little contrast here. I just want to wake up. Okay. Contrast that with, I want to be awakened to the totality of my experience, whatever arises. What's the difference? Julia?
In this case, I thought I had somebody to protect, so normally it would go from somebody to protect to from fear to feeling, it was like reversing order,
but
there was a sense, because I felt I had
something
to protect, I knew it was
right. And when you opened it to everything? Yeah. That, did you get that, Clint? This is a good thing. But that's where it ends, because as long as we're trying to do it up here, it's all just ideas. The only way you experience an idea is to think. That's this much of experience. Yeah. all of the sensory sensations, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell. That's part of our experience too. So when you're working with these practices, it's very helpful actually to think, you know, how do I see this? How do I hear this? How do I taste this? How do I smell this? How do I touch this? What are the body sensations that arise out of this? I mean, one of the techniques I use with people when they're stuck on a pattern is I'll say, what color's the pattern? Shocking pink. Oh, okay. They're stuck. Yeah. I'll ask, what color is the pattern? What sound does the pattern make? And you start opening to the other senses. Because those are, because that gets people out of their head about thinking about the pattern. And is not as threatening as asking, you know, what does the, you can go from there into what, how do you experience the pattern in your body? But it just gets them right out of their head. You know, what color is it? But everybody gets a color like that. And everybody gets a sound. Mind you, some people will suppress that in the next microsecond. It's there. Okay.
So can yes. we get back to that place where we were, you know, we're nauseated and we have to, you know, we hit rock bottom.
I don't want to go there.
You took us there. And then we are going to go the opposite of what our inclination originally of the anger. So, yeah. And it feels to me very similar to giving away my happiness and the taking and sending. That not wanting to part with that.
Yeah.
And it's a total change of, it's almost, you're saying, what word is it? It's like recreating myself in order to be the person that's going to...
Yeah.
So is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking.
And as I said in a previous class, it's very important that you, I think Randy used, offer the word supple. That you be supple in this. If you become hard and rigid, right. You're suppressing. And that's, so if you're going to... You've got to stay open and that suppleness with the experience, because if it's like this, if you, this is not about white knuckling through it. You can't do it that way.
Or passive-aggressive behavior.
Well, it'll become passive-aggressive almost certainly.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, in compassion circles, passive-aggressive behavior abounds. Mm. Nonprofit organizations? Michelle, then Randy. Michelle, then Randy.
What's the difference between the intention of these instructions and the Christian directive about turning the other cheek?
Well, I can't speak for Christianity, but to my mind, there's no difference. This is the level at which Christianity, I think, was originally directed. It was a mystical tradition, and frankly, I think both Buddhism and Christianity and Taoism all picked it up from the same place, which was Zoroastrianism in Persia, which had a very strong ethic of compassion, the myth of the universal savior, and the vow of compassion, the myth of the universal savior, which became in Buddhism the Amitabha cult. And in Judaism, it became Christianity.
Because when I think of my experience of Christianity now, and I think of that phrase, it has an aura of a great deal of suppression.
Yeah.
And a kind of a component of pity in it also.
Yes, and that I don't think is how it was originally intended. I can't imagine that it was. If you want to read, get a flavor of early Christianity, you pick up a little book called Wisdom of the Desert Fathers by Thomas Merton. These are anecdotes about the Cenobites who lived in the Egyptian desert in around 300 or 400 AD. They're great. And you get lovely stories. Some people came to see one anchorite, and he served them a nice meal. And these guys lived on next to nothing, so he used the very last of his food to serve them a nice meal. And why don't you go and see so and so? He knows much more than I, and somebody much further out in the desert. But he said, but when you go, give them this. I can't remember the details. And so when they gave him this, he immediately understood the message from his fellow anchorite. And so he regaled them with a tremendously long sermon and served them nothing. This is how these guys communicate. But they're all about teaching, and there's so many of the anecdotes that I recall of which are reminiscent of taking and sending. And don't forget that turn the other cheek was Christ's response directly to someone quoting the Torah, saying an eye for an eye, and so he said, yeah, but Randy.
So we're really trapped.
Yeah.
This spinning cycle. I mean, something humiliating in front of a crowd. If you turn the crowd would just and said, "Oh, I feel compassionate about you." The crowd would look at you, and they would strangle. They would. I mean, it's probably like American Idol or something like that. You know, to see this, and I've never seen it. I was reading an article on it. To see a host like that put the people down, and that's what brings the ratings up. I mean, that's almost felt like in this.
No, this isn't about Simon. This is not Simon.
But, I mean, it's almost like sending the wrong message. I mean, person who cared for like a child treats you as your worst enemy. And then maybe it's what Deborah said last week when he said, well, that's the perception we have of the world. Why is that the right way to go? But to treat you like your enemy, lavish them with love. What kind of teaching is that?
Tough. Yeah. And this is what the whole discussion is about tonight.
It's like they would continue taking advantage.
It's almost like where Clint's story went at the very, like he could take it so far, but if it meant them then carrying it a step further, mm-hmm. And I guess that's sort of what I thought maybe you were going to touch on before you got into the engaged Buddhism.
Okay. Rinpoche said at the beginning of the retreat, a cow flicks its own flies, a monk watches his own actions. Now, he said this to us because we're going to live, seven guys together, on half an acre of ground for 3 years. And Rinpoche's taught a few three-year retreats. He knows what happens. Sooner or later, somebody gets the bright idea to tell somebody else that they're not doing it right. They're not behaving right. So he, typical Eastern fashion, he gives us this little dictum. You don't get to tell anybody that they're not doing it right. Your concern, or our concern in this, is to undo our own investment in things, in truth, in this, which are all projections of a sense of self, actually. One may object to that. They're all projections of a sense of self. Truth, justice, all of these things. Pride, self-importance, you know, I can do it right, all of these things. That's the point of these instructions. These are not instructions about rules for developing a good society. One can have a whole argument about that. They may or may, no, they may be, but that's not what they were originally developed for. They were developed so that you undid a habituated way of relating to the world and could move into something far more open. Now, there are many, many levels here, and I don't want to cloud the picture too much. You've probably had experiences like this, where somebody has done something that is really objectionable, but for whatever reason, it doesn't stir up any reaction in you. Do you know what I'm talking about? And you can say something to the person, very clear, which wakes them up. Do you understand what I mean? Okay. Could you do that if you'd been angry or irritated or offended or whatever? No. Okay. So, in the larger picture, there's a two-step process here. The first, and since we're using Christianity, is to get the log out of our own eye before we remove the mote from somebody else's. No. That's really tough instruction. Yeah. There's another whole level which we haven't touched on here, but I do want to touch in reference to your question. If you look at this as different parts of yourself speaking to you, is there any part of you that spreads slanderous and ugly rumors about you? Okay. Is there any part of you that humiliates you and denounces you in front of a crowd of people? Okay. Now, how do you actually step out of those behaviors? We have those parts in us. Those parts are really concerned, were all developed and are in place because at some point in our life, we felt we needed that behavior to protect us. And if we try to get rid of those parts directly, they will just say, I'm under attack again, whoomph, and they're really there. Do you follow? But what if you say to those parts, you know, you're really making life inconvenient for me right now, but you're still part of me. And I'm going to take care of you. What happens? Things open up. So it's another whole level. And incidentally, since we're really on Christianity, that's what the parable of the prodigal son is actually about. It's about welcoming that part that you're totally estranged, welcoming back that part that you're totally estranged from. They're all old Sufi stories. Does that help you understand this? Okay. It's 9:30. Did you get something out of this?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. I'd like to check now and then. Okay. next week. Just want to do 18 and 19. When you are down and out and held in contempt, desperately ill and emotionally crazy, don't lose heart. Take into you the suffering and negativity of all beings. Even when you are famous, honored by all, and as rich as the god of wealth himself, don't be pompous. Know that the magnificence of existence has no substance. Well, just let me think for a moment. Yeah. Because that and the next two are in pairs. Yeah. Let's do those two. Now, are you getting a flavor or a taste of how to work with these? No. I strongly recommend, and you're probably going to get tired of me saying this. I strongly recommend when you work with these practices, you let yourself feel first how your body reacts to them. And the body is going to go through a series of reactions as you allow yourself to move deeper into the instruction. But that'll be a really good thing to focus on. You know, how am I reacting to this? I mean, let's take the first one. When you're down and out and held in contempt, desperately ill and emotionally crazy, don't lose heart. How does your body react at that point? Yes, that's right. What?
Yikes.
Yes, good. That's where you start. Don't skip over that yikes. Yeah, that's the first thing. He's got to be kidding. This can't be serious. And so you feel that reaction. And then as you feel that reaction, you let the instruction come into you even more. Okay. What would it be like to actually do that? And now you're going to get a very different experience in your body. This you can do in your meditation periods. You know, doing it once or twice gives you the idea, but actually letting yourself feel this. This is how this is where you're really reflecting on and moving into meditating on these. Because these are not difficult to understand, but it's how you actually get them into you. Feeling them in your body. And then when you've gone through the body, then you can go through the emotions, then you can go through the stories, but you always work that way. Never start with the stories, you'll never get anywhere. Okay.
That's what I was going to ask you, is it helpful to bring stories into it?
Only when you're clear, you're able to stay clear and present in your body. Before then, we usually get lost in our stories. We think they're right.
What if you can't access that feeling?
In the body?
It's hard to access it.
Access which feeling? Yikes?
Well, just the ones before you and embarrassed.
Okay. Let's take number 17. Okay? So this is for you, Molly. Even if your peers or subordinates put you down to make themselves look better, what's going on in your body right now?
I'm sick.
Okay, there you are. That wasn't so hard to access.
Well, you're always really good at that.
But I just read it. No, but you can do the same thing.
You know what? Even then, I imagined something. Like, yeah. I went to an experience that I had.
Okay. And now go to your body in that experience,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's fine. But, you know, you can you can recall an experience, but go to your body.
Okay.
Okay.